Good morning. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week. Over the weekend, the continuing debate over the debt ceiling issue made all sorts of news headlines, even as it appears that members of the public are unhappy with the process, no matter how it was going to turn out. As of this hour, or a few hours ago anyway, it looks like there is a deal in the works, and we will be catching up with the latest on that with our guest this hour. Joe Foy is with us, an assistant professor of American Democracy and Media Studies at UW Parkside. And we'll be talking with him about the deal reached over the debt ceiling and what it might mean and what has to happen next, because we can't forget about all that either. We'd like to hear from you, too. What do you think of the process, of the debate, both the tone and the substance, and now the possible deal surrounding that debt ceiling? As of this morning, do you think we are where we should be? Call with your comments and questions at 800-642-1234. That is 800-642-1234. You can also join the discussion by using email. That address is talk@WPR.org. And don't forget that you can also follow the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook if you'd like to do that. Joe Foy, good morning. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, Gene. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and it looks like we've got a deal. We've been reading about it, hearing about it over the course of the morning. And I just want to read you a line from an editorial that was published this morning in USA Today, that the episode has served us as something of a near-death experience. And I'm wondering, is that a fair thing to say about this whole debate that we saw over the weekend? Was it really near-death, or was it something less than that?
Well, of course, that's a little bit of hyperbole, but in the end, I mean, what we were really threatening here was the possibility of not being able to pay our debts, which would have not only had a severe impact here in the United States, but would have also really severely threatened the possibility of global depression. So it was, certainly not a near-death experience, but it would have had some pretty significant economic shockwaves around the world.
You know, last week we saw the markets beginning to react. At least some people were saying they were beginning to react a little bit to the lack of a deal. But there are also people who were saying, you know, there was going to be a deal all along, and everybody knew it, and it was going to be the 11th hour thing. And I'm wondering your reaction to it. Were you surprised that two things, that we wound up with a deal, and second, that we wound up with it at the 11th hour?
Not overly surprised that we ended up with a deal. I think that not just the economic ramifications, but the political ramifications were significant enough that it really forces, even individuals who don't want to swallow what I think many are looking at as a bitter pill in the final negotiations and the compromise that was come to. But when you think about the kinds of consequences over the long term, this kind of 11th hour strategy, I think actually sort of threatens the possibility of in particular international markets having a whole lot of confidence in American political leadership. And so even though there was a rallying effect sort of immediately when markets opened in other parts of the world today, I think that there is still sort of that skittish nature when it comes to investment, that can we always rely on the United States government to really pay its debts? And so that may be one of the consequences of the kind of 11th hour model that we've seen here.
Yeah, we saw the Asian markets open up this morning. Dow futures and the S&P, before they opened up, were also higher this morning as well. So some reaction to that already. But, you know, the thing about this deal is we don't really have a deal yet because it hasn't been voted on. So,
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think they're expecting the Senate sometime, later this afternoon.
Yeah.
And then they're even projecting that the House vote may become, like, quite literally that 11th hour deal, as they have until midnight tonight to have the vote before the Treasury begins to take some alternative measures.
Now, you talked earlier about some bitter pills to swallow. So let's start talking about what you know about the deal to date, realizing that we don't know everything yet and that these will be continuing to trickle out. But in terms of bitter pills, I don't know where you'd like to start, but give us the broad strokes of what this deal looks like.
Sure. Well, initially what happens is that there's going to be an immediate, I think it's roughly $917 billion in cuts to domestic discretionary spending. And then that's coupled with then a temporary, well, I want to say temporary because all of these increases seem somewhat temporary until final things are worked out. But there's going to be a stopgap measure, I guess we will say, with the debt ceiling raising it by roughly $900 billion, which should, coupled with the cuts, take us until February before then. The additional debt ceiling increase would need to take place. Now, this is tied to then a bipartisan commission then that's going to be formed of 12 legislators from both parties, sort of handpicked by both parties, who are then going to get together. They're going to make recommendations for where cuts need to happen, make recommendations on potential tax reform, reworking some of the revenue codes. In order to then be able to work out a final deal that actually gets us up to the kinds of cuts and reforms that both parties see as being really necessary in order to rein in not just debt, but the deficit itself. So we won't know really until, I think they have until the end of November to make sort of a final recommendation to both chambers of Congress, this bipartisan committee. And then it sounds like both chambers will have the opportunity to either accept all with no amendments or reject all. That's really all they've got is an up or down decision at that point.
So not to sound too cynical or anything, but it sounds like they kicked a can down the road.
A little bit. And I think that in doing so, though, what they open up as a potential opportunity is that it gives members of Congress who are concerned with reelection possibilities, the opportunity to first of all say that this was a congressional proposal rather than one that was coming from the president, and secondarily then it was bipartisan and that they had little room to negotiate anything beyond it. And so then that's going to give them a little bit of sort of an out with their constituencies should they need it. And in the end, by kicking it down, then that really offers up that possibility of getting a final deal, and avoiding the potential risks of what we would see if we didn't get everything under control and a final ceiling raised.
So, in your opinion, how did we wind up in this situation? You know, everybody said we don't want a default. Everybody seemed to sort of agree on that. But here we are. We were waiting for a last-second vote to avoid it. So what brought us up to this 11th and a half hour?
Well, it seems that for what appears to be the first time really in history, this kind of debt ceiling increase was going to be used as a political tool to gain leverage the kinds of spending cuts, the kinds of political action that political parties were, really wanting. And so in particular, when you look at what is being sort of labeled as that Tea Party coalition within the Republican Party, when they come in and they have significant cuts that they want to see made, by pushing this kind of debt ceiling politics into what we call brinkmanship kind of politics of, we're going to take it right to the edge and, the other person knows what's being risked, then that's where we end up in this kind of situation where, again, for the first time in history, tying the debt ceiling increase then to these kinds of political outcomes is what gets us to this point because the impact is so significant, the consequences are so significant that this becomes a really powerful tool of leverage for parties or for factions of parties to begin to use in order to be able to drive some really significant inroads into the kinds of policies that they want.
You know, as I listen to the broad outlines of the deal that you've mentioned, it doesn't seem like it was anything that should have taken this long, but yet it did. So does that tell us just how tough the politics behind it were?
I think so, yeah. I mean, because even right now, it's not a certainty that we're going to get passage later today. It seems like that's going to be the case, but as Speaker Boehner had mentioned yesterday, the leaders have come together on these kinds of things, but there's no deal until, they talk to Congress and until the members of both chambers get together to vote. And it's pretty clear that even amongst some of the leadership in these chambers, they're not really happy, either party, with what ends up coming out here. And so I think it was described as if compromise means nobody gets what they want, then this is an overwhelming success.
But, you know, the one thing that is sort of absent from this deal that I can, at least from what I can see, is any mention of tax increases of any kind. And that was a key element of the Democrats' stance for a long time.
Right. And then so what is being sort of, I don't want to say masked in all of this, is whether or not there's the possibility for that bipartisan commission to recommend tax increases, recommend the suspension of the Bush-era tax cuts, or whether or not to reform, again, some of the revenue code in order to then be able to increase the kind of amount of money that is coming into the federal government, rather than just sort of looking at this as entirely a cutting process. And one of the areas where the Democrats have potential leverage here, because this was certainly an issue that they were really wanting to press, is in the area of defense spending. Because if they don't come to an agreement by the, I think it again, it's November 23rd deadline that the bipartisan commission needs to come to, then automatic cuts kick in, and 50% of those come from defense spending. So it's really pushing us into this kind of decision-making that, you know, the Republicans faced in 1990, when George H.W. Bush kept saying, read my lips, no new taxes, no new taxes. But when faced with the possibility then of cutting in the area of defense, he agreed to tax increases to generate revenue.
And lost the election.
Right, right. So there are going to be severe, I think, political consequences that both political parties are looking at. They've been looking at during this entire debate, and I think that we're going to still see that same kind of concern, the same kind of obstacles that appeared in the 535 members, they're going to reappear in the 12-member commission as well. So they're going to have to be, you know, very conscious of the political impacts of any kind of decision that they make for both parties.
So realizing that, you know, it still has to be voted on, it's not quite a done deal just yet. Is it too early to start picking winners and losers in this in terms of Democrats and Republicans?
Well, I think it's actually going to be too hard to know what that exactly means in terms of winning and losing. In part, it's going to be tied to what comes out of the commission. But in addition to that, it's really hard to sort of say, well, here's what it means to win in this particular case. If we were looking just at the decision that has at least been agreed upon to this point, then we could say when it comes from a policy perspective, the Republican Party has won a major victory, especially given that you know they don't hold the majority in the Senate, they don't hold the presidency, and so to be able to have nearly everything that they had initially been calling for, sort of collectively as a party, with no tax increases, with no increases in revenue coming in, then this is a really significant victory when it comes to policy. But when we start talking about electoral consequences, that becomes another area of whether or not then it's going to bear out that the Republican position of sort of anti-coalition politics is going to serve them well when it comes to election time. If they're seen as the party that has taken us to the brink, was unwilling to compromise, was unwilling to negotiate, then that may have some pretty significant impacts when it comes to sort of the independent or moderate voters within the United States, which could then be a boon for the Democratic Party. So it's really hard to sort of negotiate out what winning and losing means at this phase.
Yeah, I want to go back to this bipartisan commission again, because we just had a bipartisan commission on the debt release a pretty extensive report, you know, I don't know, 6-9 months ago, something like that. And it seems like it answered a lot of those questions at that time. Is all that work just out the window then?
It's not, because what it does is it sets a framework for where those kinds of discussions are going to take place, given the very limited window that this commission has to work. They're going to need a lot of that kind of the recommendations and the sort of molding and scaffolding set in so that they can move and operate more quickly to meet the late November deadline. And so in that regard, then, that work is not entirely out the window. But what makes this different, again, is the sort of policy power that this bipartisan commission has that the other didn't. And in this case, you get the opportunity to write the legislation then that that again is an all up or all down, no possibility for amendments, no real possibility other than sort of pro forma debate to take place at that point. So it'll help with the groundwork.
All right, we're going to take a break, and when we do, we will return and continue our discussion on the current deal over the debt ceiling. And just as you know, we are trying to get U.S. Representative Gwen Moore on the line with her reaction to the current deal, and as soon as we're able to get her office, we'll bring her to you and spend about 5 minutes with her and find out what her reaction to all of this is. In the meantime, we'll take a break, and when we return, we will continue that discussion right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 24 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today filling in for Joy Cardine. We're talking about the debt ceiling and the new deal that was just passed, announced overnight. It is now heading to the various bodies of Congress, and we'll see where it goes to from there. And we have a member of Congress who is with us on the line this morning, and I'm hoping that she is here now. Congresswoman Gwen Moore from the 4th District of the Congress joins us on the line. And Congresswoman, are you there? Okay, let's try this line. Congresswoman, are you there?
I am.
All right, there we go. All these buttons and knobs and everything. Well, first of all, thanks for taking the time to join us. I imagine you're a little busy this morning. First question I have for you, were you surprised we got a deal? And second, what do you think of it?
Well, I went back and forth on thinking of whether or not we were going to be able to get a deal. I started out believing surely that every member of the House of Representatives and the Senate was concerned about not defaulting on our debt. And I became a little concerned with the machinations over the weekend. But once again, the Congress has managed to cobble something together for us to vote on.
So when you say cobble something together, it sounds like there's a few things in there you're not too crazy about?
There are a lot of things that I'm not crazy about in this deal. Starting out with, I just want to start out by complimenting the President of the United States. I know he has drawn a lot of criticism from people like me. I'm a progressive, and I'm also a member of the Black Caucus. But I do think that literally the White House has been stormed, and the Tea Party has rushed in and literally put a gun to his head. And he does have the stewardship over the entire country to be concerned with. And I admire him for responding coolly under this pressure. And I just want to say to all the listeners out there that elections have consequences, and you also have to admire the energy of the Tea Party. I mean, they were a minority group within the Republican Party who were determined to literally change the game, literally, with respect to the social contract that Americans have had since the New Deal, with their own New Deal, because I think ultimately we have absolutely no revenues. The rich and the very rich and powerful are protected in this deal. If the committee that's being put together doesn't come up with $1.5 trillion worth of cuts, and I'm saying cuts, and even though revenue could be on the table, it's hard to believe that there could be an agreement on revenue. If they don't come up with another $1.5 trillion in cuts, then there will be an automatic cross-the-board cut, a lot of pain to a lot of very vulnerable people. Now, I am happy that Medicare beneficiaries are protected, but there will be cuts to providers, and that might reduce access to doctors for seniors. Social Security and perhaps Medicaid are protected sequestered under this deal. But I think and veterans benefits, so that is somewhat of a relief. So, but literally everything else. Pell grants for students, home health heating assistance for seniors, food stamps, consumer protection, environmental protection, all will be on the chopping block. And I think that that we are moving, you know, in a retrograde. This is a retrograde movement in terms of those things. You know, I think we're a great country because the government intervenes in corporate activities. It prevents just the willy-nilly destruction of consumer protection and environmental protection and care for the poor and the young in our country. And when we're back to becoming a yo-yo society where you're on your own.
So as the deal stands at this moment in time, are you planning to vote for it?
Well, I can tell you that I have not seen anything except newspaper reports. We're having a caucus at about noon or 1 o'clock, and I very much look forward to going to that caucus and getting the details. I haven't seen anything, and I've learned the hard way not to make commitments before I actually see the facts. I'm going strictly by news accounts and news reports. I can tell you, though, that it will be very difficult because you know, everything that I care about, everything that I've represented all these years, is on the line. And I would just admonish your listeners again, the Tea Party is bound and determined to change the social contract. And we, you know, if people care about Pell Grants and consumer protection and the environment, they need to realize that elections have consequences, and we need to become as energized over these issues as they have. They have really set an example that we can no longer afford to be reticent and unresolved in our participation in the body politic.
Well, Congresswoman Moore, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and good luck with the caucus.
Thank you, Gene.
Congresswoman Gwen Moore of Wisconsin's 4th District joining us, and we appreciate her taking the time. And as a side note, we also invited Congressman Reed Ribble and Sean Duffy to join us, but they were unable to do so this morning. We hope to have them on maybe a little bit later on this week and see how that all goes. In the meantime, we are continuing our discussion of the debt ceiling here on the Ideas Network and the current deal that is just being worked out. We're just learning the details of it. And as you just heard, even members of Congress don't quite have those details yet. Later on, Congresswoman Moore will be voting on this, and she's going to a caucus in, oh boy, 3 or 4 more hours, and she will learn what the outlines of that deal looks like. And so that is what we are talking about this hour, a deal that not everybody quite knows the outlines of. Joe Foy is joining us, though. He is an assistant professor of American Democracy and Media Studies at the UW Parkside, and we are talking with him this hour about what he knows about this as well. And Joe Foy, you're still with us, I hope?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. We're glad to have you along. Thanks for sticking around during that. You heard Congresswoman Moore there talking about her reaction to the plan so far. Are you surprised that members of Congress, even at this late date, you know, hours from when they're going to have to vote on this, really don't have those outlines, those details that they might need to make a decision?
Again, not really, only because the decision or the deal was initially reached by leadership, you know, at a very late hour, and so then trying to manage the flow of the information out where everybody's getting clear and accurate information on what exactly the deal is becomes a little bit of a difficulty for party leadership. And so trying to manage that information and sort of giving them, these specific meetings where they'll go through, I know, Speaker Boehner's PowerPoint presentation that he's put together is already out circulating on the Internet, to where he's going to sit down and go sort of line by line to really inform membership within the House exactly what this entails. And so in that regard, then, I'm not too surprised, but it is a little bit unnerving to think about the fact that they're not even going to have full details for another few hours, and then by the end of the day, they're going to have to vote on that. And when there's so much on the line, as Congressman Moore had spoken of, in terms of what their political careers are about, what they've worked for, It is an exercise in this great democracy, and we'll have to see how it turns out.
Congresswoman Moore did mention the Tea Party, and she said she admired their energy. And I'm wondering, is the Tea Party a winner in all of this? I mean, to what extent did they drive that debate on the Republican side?
I think that they were in the driver's seat, not just on the Republican side, but for all political actors in this. It seemed as though very early on the Tea Party was able to set the tone. They were able to sort of capture the dialogue in terms of the kinds of phrases that were being circulated about cut, cap, and balance. And so in that regard, then, the Tea Party really was driving a lot of the dialogue. Again, I think from a policy perspective, this is a major victory for the Tea Party faction of the Republican Party and for that wing of conservatism in the United States. What the long-term electoral consequences are going to be, though, is relatively unforeseeable. In part because of the way in which, we still have to see what the bipartisan commission can come up with. And likewise, there may be a potential backlash amongst, again, moderates and independent voters who are not happy with the way that the process went and really want to see compromise. They want to see coalition because that's what, this democracy has really been about. And so, again, in that regard, I think from a policy perspective, this is a major victory for the Tea Party. Long term, though, we're going to have to, I think, see the consequences play out.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Phil joins us from Madison. Hi, Phil. Hello. And we apparently have lost Phil, and so we'll move on to Diane, who joins us from Prairie du Sac. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
Hi.
Yes, I would just like to say I have a comment on how all of it was handled.
Okay.
I thought that most of our representatives that were on the air a lot were irresponsible children, that they are adults. And I think because we have a black president, and I've heard many, many times Mitch McConnell say, just one term president. We don't want him another term. And the same with John Boehner. And I think that to talk about our president that way. And I truly believe that is why the debt ceiling issue was such a major issue with the Tea Party and the Republicans. I felt all of them, even the Democrats, did not handle it like adults should handle a conversation. And during the Bush years, from listening to the news, it was like it was dusting a table, just turning on a light. It was very easy to raise the debt ceiling, and this time for a whole month, that's all that has been on the news, and we really do have more important issues to deal with, like jobs.
Diane, thanks for the call, and Joe Foy, that whole disconnect, some people are calling it, between jobs and the economy and so on, and the way members of Congress and the White House have been acting. I mean, Diane's not alone in her opinion.
No, not at all. And that's why right at this point, we're seeing, again, below 20% approval ratings, incredibly low approval ratings for Congress as an institution. Recently, President Obama hit 40% approval rating, which is the lowest in his presidency, a drop of 10 percentage points over the span of just a couple months when this whole thing started. And so there really is that sort of, that negative kind of backlash to the way in which the process happened. And in particular, I think that there is that concern that we're still sitting, above 9% unemployment. The economy is not growing at the speed that people would hope that it's growing. And so with Congress's attention, the president's attention diverted to this issue right now, I think that there really is a concern with whether or not government is going to be able to act and respond quickly enough in order to be able to put us on the right track economically. And I do want to kind of add to that this is where that bipartisan commission is going to have a significant amount of power. Because if, in fact, we're looking at cuts at domestic spending, then the government's ability to be able to actually work on job creation, job growth programs is going to be made more difficult because they're not going to have some of the resources to do so. So, again, this is why this is such a longer-term conversation that we have to wait to sort of really project all the consequences.
Let's go to Scott. Scott is with us from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I guess what bothers me more than anything else is it seems to be a lack of intellectual honesty on this whole subject and a lack of the public being educated more than anything else. I mean, you heard about the risk of default, which there was never going to be a default because default is if we don't pay our bondholders, and we were always going to pay our bondholders, and also the risk of being downgraded. Standard & Poor's is still thinking about downgrading us, and it had nothing to do with the debt ceiling. They're concerned about our debt, which until the Tea Party came along, this really wasn't a subject that was on the radar. I mean, Standard & Poor's still may downgrade us because our debt is so massive. You know, even with this bipartisan bill, we're looking at maybe cutting, I don't know, $2.5 trillion. That's over 10 years. That's a little over $200 billion a year in cuts when we're running a $1.5 trillion deficit this year. I mean, that really doesn't get us to a point of solvency. I mean, it doesn't get us to a point where we're actually managing and taking care of our debt. And you just don't hear that conversation that much. I mean, I'm glad this is done. I'm glad it's off the table. But it's really just tinkering around because nobody wants to talk about Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, which are the three big cost drivers. And you just don't have that intellectual conversation. You don't have the press trying to educate the people because the politicians aren't going to tell you the truth. And I guess I think the press needs to step up and let us know exactly what's going on.
Scott, thanks for the call. And Joe Foy, what about that? I mean, are we missing a big part of this conversation that Scott says we are, that, you know, the debt ceiling is certainly one thing, but the debt is something else again?
Well, I think that that's part of the larger conversation that will be held and that has been a part of the ongoing deliberations. I don't want to say, though, that this has not been, you know, part of the conversation for a long time within American politics. This was something that was such a significant part of politics within the 1990s that between, granted, riding the wave of significant economic growth in the mid to late 1990s, but coupled with some caps and spending cuts to various programs. We not only had a balanced budget, we were running a budget surplus at the end of the 1990s and moving into 2000, right? That had been a concern for quite some time. When you have coupled then the international security issues with terrorism mixed in then with severe economic downturn and consequence, the conversation about debt and deficit, you know, ends up taking maybe a lower position on the public agenda while we're dealing with some of these other really major catastrophes, but it remains, I think, continually a part of it. So whereas I think Scott is right, you know, we all ought to become more informed, become more aware of all of the consequences of decision-making and what those things mean. I don't want to say that it hasn't been part of, you know, the kind of ongoing deliberations within American politics.
And how did the media do? I mean, from what I saw, at least over the weekend, it kind of felt like a horse race to me.
Well, and that seems to be what a lot of the media's attention is when it comes to politics. Again, the notion of who's ahead, who's behind, who's going to win, who's going to lose, how do we cast this into a particular narrative, rather than really working through an informative process in terms of what potential consequences are and really working on, and I think that this was part of Scott's concern, the information side of really just sort of informing people rather than speculating who's ahead, who's behind, that has become a part of that really 24-hour news cycle phenomenon.
And David joins us now from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, hey, morning. You know, I wanted to ask, and I sure wish I could have gotten on with a congresswoman because I had a very particular question, and she probably could have answered it. And that's, I'm on Thomas Locator. What is it? Thomas.loc.gov, and I've got the what's titled the Budget Control Act of 2011, and it's S627, and then that's tied to House resolutions of 373, 383, and 1564, and it comes up as a Well, I'm wondering about Christmas tree bills, and what's tied to, you know, what's the pork in this, and so the Congresswoman, I would really have hoped to be able to ask her some of the good details, because basically I'm looking at the baby boom have been cheated and cheated and cheated, and the savings and loans crooks never got prosecuted, the subprime crooks, there have been so many of these scandals all during the Jimmy Carter years, when three quarters of American farms disappeared. Or, no, he didn't have that big of a loss. Reagan Bush was three quarters of American farms. But this whole idea that the baby boom has been cheated and cheated and cheated, and we're never getting our money back. They're never prosecuting these people, and now we're paying a debt that's based upon how much we got cheated. So it's like, why in the world are we believing these organized crime numbers? You know, they're cheating us. They never get prosecuted. They get to keep the money, and with that money, they then cheat us, and then we have to pay for their bill.
All right, David in San Francisco, and Joe Foy. One of the things he was getting at there, I think, obviously he thinks that we've been cheated, or at least some people have been cheated. But he's also curious, I think, about you know, is there pork involved with this, or is there another side to this bill that we don't know about?
Yeah, the phenomenon, the Christmas tree bill kind of phenomenon that he was referring to, is when you have a major piece of legislation, and then like ornaments, seemingly every member of Congress can sort of hang their own particular interest onto that as a way of making sure that that all gets through. Again, lacking the real specifics of what's going to come out of this, I have not had the opportunity to go through Thomas and to look at all of the various things that are connected with this, nor will we know for sure by the end what all is going to be attached to this by the end until we actually have a vote in the Senate, a vote in the House. So in that regard, then, there may be potential for that to be, for those kinds of things to be added on to the legislation, but barring any sort of, you know, specific final tallies, it's hard to say, well, here's where the pork is going to be, here's where the special projects are going to be. Given the amounts of cuts that are taking place, it would be, I think, really hard to then add additional sort of spending project things on there, but that doesn't discount the possibility that other sort of pet projects wouldn't be somehow included in.
Yeah, never say never, I guess.
Right.
Joe Foy is with us this hour. He is an assistant professor of American Democracy and Media Studies at UW Parkside. And we're talking about the deal on the debt ceiling, at least the one we know about at this moment in time. It is still sort of coming together as we speak, and we are getting reaction to it. I'm Gene Purcell in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 12 minutes before 9 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guest recap the nation's top news stories. And that's coming up after 9 here in the Ideas Network. This hour, we are talking about one of the top news stories, the deal on the debt ceiling that was announced last night and is being talked about all over the place this morning. Details haven't fully emerged from this yet, but we're talking about what we do know with Joe Foy, an assistant professor of American Democracy and Media Studies at UW Parkside. Let's go back to the phones right now. Mary is with us from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm dismayed with the deal because there are no tax increases for the corporations and the wealthy in them. And I realize there's going to be some pain, but they have no pain from this. I wonder, as an example, there was something in the paper a couple weeks ago about Congressman Ryan having lunch with a couple of lobbyists and that the wine on the table was $350 a bottle. I assure you that those lobbyists deducted that from their expense account and paid no taxes on that $350. Well, $350 is the sum total of my sister's monthly income. That's obscene that they can spend $350 on lunch for a bottle of wine, and it's okay. Anything in the corporate world is okay if you can get away with it. And it's obscene when you compare that to someone taking that same amount of money and paying for housing, food, and getting no health care, and getting no dental care because they're so poor. I'm tired of the obscenity.
Mary, thanks for the call. And Joe Foy, Mary and Madison, dismayed. And that whole issue of tax increases, revenue side of the equation, coming to fore again. Are we going to be hearing a lot more about that, do you think?
I think so. I mean, that's part of what can potentially, again, come out of this bipartisan commission, is that there would be the call for increases in taxes, or at the very least, the White House has already begun to talk about the possibility of, pushing not just for the elimination, not renewing the Bush-era tax cuts, but even vetoing should Congress vote to extend those in 2012 when they're set to expire. In that regard, there is the possibility that these kinds of things may become a part of the additional $1.5 trillion in cuts that the bipartisan commission has to come up with, that it may not just be cutting. There may be avenues for additional revenue streams through that kind of review of the revenue code. Now, that being said, I think that some of the concerns that Mary expressed were some of those same concerns then that we heard from Congresswoman Moore, and that become the biggest concern for the Democratic Party right now, which is the notion that Congresswoman Moore described it as the rewriting of the social contract, but the sort of notion that that there would be all cuts and that there wouldn't be sort of additional revenue lines is something that is really depressing the kind of mobilized support from not just Democrats within Congress, but white stream rank and file Democrats across the country. So again, there are potential election consequences if the Democrats are unable to capture any kind of real reform that serves their agenda as well.
Earlier you suggested that the Tea Party was, could justifiably be proud, I guess, of their role in getting us to this point. But as we move forward with the commission, what's to say that the Tea Party still won't be in this same sort of position, and we know what their stance on revenues or tax increases or however you want to phrase that is?
Well, the real key indicator today is going to be how many votes Speaker Boehner is going to be able to deliver on this agreement. Because if he's unable to deliver a majority of the votes from the Republican side in the House, and if he's also unable to even deliver, the number of votes that would be necessary if matched with the Democrats to let it pass, this is a real crisis within his leadership. And there's a possibility even of trying to find a way to find new leadership within there, because this is a really fractionalized Republican Party as well. And so in this regard, the Tea Party can be confident that what they've done is driven the agenda. But again, the long-term consequences, even for the Republican Party and Republican leadership, is something that has been, severely hurt. Even down to at one time the Republican Party's banner carrier John McCain, really calling out members of his own party on the floor of the Senate last week. That really shows that kind of internal divide that, again, may have some serious consequences for the Republicans as well.
John joins us now from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. I wanted to agree with Scott and an earlier caller who had talked about the importance of the national debt and how we should make it a higher priority. But at the same time, I wanted to remind people that in 2000, when Bill Clinton left office, the national debt was about $5 trillion. And when George W. Bush left office, the national debt was about $11 trillion. And I seem, we have to look at things historically. And if you look historically at leadership, I think one of the first things that Bill Clinton did when he got into office is he did focus on the debt. I never voted for Bill Clinton. I voted for Ross Perot. But Bill Clinton pushed through a tax cut that politically devastated the Democrats. But at the same time, after he pushed through that tax increase in 1992, the economy went on to 8 continuous years of economic growth. And I think he created 20 million new jobs, which averaged out to about 250,000 new jobs a month for the whole time he was in office. When George W. Bush got into office, he was given a surplus. It was still a very large national debt of $5 trillion. But I seem to remember one of the things that he used to push through the tax cuts was we were paying down the national debt too quickly, is what he said. So I think you have to look historically at the differences between Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and their leadership. George W. Bush did a tax cut while leading us into two wars. Bill Clinton took a political hit for increasing taxes, and the economy went on to 8 continuous years of economic growth and 250,000 new jobs a month. So we need to look at things historically. But I do agree with Scott that we do need to emphasize, put some emphasis and focus on the debt like Bill Clinton did.
John, thanks for the call. Joe Foy, first of all, what do you think about John's interpretation of history? And secondly, what can we learn from history?
Well, I think that John's absolutely right in terms of being able to, in particular, have a better understanding of the kind of ideological debates that are occurring right now by looking at very similar instances within history. Now, again, I think that there's sort of the possibility that we, you know, sometimes shove too much into the analogies of history, but certainly we can look at, you know, past instances where similar commissions have been formed in the mid-1980s, with Graham Rudman Hollings under the Reagan administration dealing with issues of debt and deficit as well, and so we can see kind of how those commissions have been used in the past. We can see what likely outcomes of that are going to be. We can learn from that process. Likewise, in engaging in ideological debates about whether or not to do this entirely through cuts, whether or not it should be done through revenue generation, some hybrid of both, then we might look at past instances when faced with very similar situations, when we have pursued particular strategies. In the Clinton case, it was not only a matter of increasing taxes, but it was also a matter of restructuring some governmental programs. In that regard, then, there was sort of this combination bipartisan effort that did lead to the creation of new jobs. Again, there's the possibility that what we're seeing there is also the dot-com boom, the deregulation of the credit industry that in the end led to a financial crisis at the time really flooding the markets with new monies, which allowed for new job creation. But certainly I don't want to undersell the role that President Clinton and at that time a Republican Congress coming together through bipartisan cooperation had in helping the economy not just rebound but really flourish and bringing the deficit under control to where we had a surplus, which would have actually, if we would have been able to pursue the same kind of line of growth and surplus that we had without changes, we wouldn't have a national debt anymore. At least after 12 years after the Clinton presidency is what it was projected. And so, again, I think that these kinds of historical situations can give us really strong insight as we look at a possible avenue forward for what we should pursue.
We've only got about a minute or so left, and in the time we have left, what do you think is going to be happening next? Is this likely to pass both houses? Could it all still fall apart?
Potentially, it could all still fall apart as members of Congress receive details, as we heard from Congresswoman Moore. That was very insightful. And so there is the possibility that this still could fall apart. And then, you know, we have to start thinking about not only what the Treasury's response is going to be, but whether or not there can be an executive response, some of the constitutional legal questions about whether or not the 14th Amendment can be invoked in order to be able to secure the payment of American bills. And so in that regard, then, there is still that possibility, and so it's important to keep a close eye on this, see how the conversation goes, but then not sort of leave the conversation to the side when we move into November if the bipartisan commission is formed.
Well, Joe Foy, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate your time. Joe Foy has been with us for the past hour or so, an assistant professor of American Democracy and Media Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and he's been talking with us about the debt ceiling. Thanks also to Congresswoman Gwen Moore, who joined us for a few moments during the course of the hour to give us her take on what's happening with the debt ceiling debate. The program was produced by Rob Ferret, and we had on-air production from Bill Martins this morning. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here this week filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.